So let's start with a meditation. So again, we'll do a shamatha practice, focusing on the abdomen. This time we'll only do one session, but it'll be a little bit longer, 24 minutes. I'll give a little bit of instruction at the beginning of the session, but then for the rest of the session I'll remain quiet to allow you to get into the practice a little bit more. Okay? So finding a nice comfortable posture. Again, allowing your awareness to descend into the body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And keeping the body as still as possible, avoiding any unnecessary movement or fidgeting. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. letting go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future. In particular, letting go of any expectations for this meditation. Letting go of all of these things. And simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now narrow your focus and focus on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. And focus on them using bare attention, meaning observe them directly, without commenting, without visualizing or imagining. Simply directly observe the bare tactile sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. And maintain that ongoing flow of mindfulness throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. And balancing the mind, overcoming dullness and distraction by, on each out-breath, relaxing, releasing any distractions, and on each in-breath, arousing and refreshing the focus. And if you find yourself constantly becoming distracted, and if you find it helpful, then you can use counting the breath to help stabilize the mind. If you don't find counting helpful, then just leave it out. So let's now continue to practice in silence. So let's begin to have a look at the text that we're going to follow. And we can begin by looking actually at the title of the text on the front page. And here it says the title is The Main Path of the Victors, a root text for the precious Gelug Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra. So what does this word Mahamudra mean? To find that out, actually, there's a part of the text that it gives that explanation. If you go to page 3 of your text, in the middle, or towards the bottom, actually, it says, "Why is that which is taught here called Mahamudra?" And then it's quoting a particular sutra, the King of Concentration Sutra, which says, "The nature of all phenomena is a seal." Seal meaning stamp. "In that way, since emptiness is the nature of all phenomena, it is a seal." And seal here is a translation of the Sanskrit word mudra, meaning that what we're going to see is that all phenomena are empty of independent existence. Nothing exists independently, meaning everything has as their ultimate nature emptiness. So everything is stamped by emptiness as its ultimate nature. So that's what it means for emptiness to be the stamp or seal. And then it says, "And since when it is realized," i.e. when we realize emptiness, "one is liberated from all degenerations, it is great or supreme." So maha, the Sanskrit word maha, means great or supreme. So emptiness is mudra, is the seal, because it stamps everything. That's the nature of everything, the ultimate nature. And when we come to realize that, then we can achieve the great or supreme goal of enlightenment. So hence maha. So that is what the word maha mudra means. And so sometimes translated into English as the great seal. Then if we go back to the front page again, it says that this is a root text for the precious Gelug Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra. So actually in your text, you see that some things are in bold and some things are normal type. The text that is in bold is the root text. And you'll find that that is, of course, very short. So often when we get a root text, it gives a very brief, succinct explanation of something. But then often whoever wrote that root text, often they'll write their own commentary to the root text to sort of explain all the various things in the root text, because often the root text is very compacted and sometimes doesn't really fully explain. It just gives really the essence. So here, this text, as we see, is written by Panchen Losang Chögyi Gyaltsen, and we'll talk about a bit about who that is shortly. So he wrote this root text, which is just the type in bold. But then he also wrote what's called an auto-commentary. He wrote a much more extensive text explaining the meaning of his root text. And so what we have here then is, what I've done is I've added some bits from the auto-commentary to sort of make it more clear, the meaning of the root text. I haven't added the whole lot because it's quite large. So I've taken bits out of the auto-commentary to help explain some of the bits of the root text. So all the type that's not bold is coming from his auto-commentary. Okay? So when it says the root text, then we're really just talking about what's in bold. And it says, a root text for the precious Gelug Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra. So remember, Mahamudra is the system of practice that was brought into Tibet through the great Indian masters Tulopa and Naropa. So we have the great Indian masters, the lineage coming through mainly Tulopa and Naropa. So again, this is around the 10th, 11th century. And those instructions were passed to the great Tibetan translator Marpa. And his main disciple, probably the most famous yogi in all of Tibet, in the history of Tibet, is Milarepa. And one of his main disciples is Gampopa. So this lineage of Mahamudra instructions is how it came into Tibet. Now, contemporary to Tulopa and Naropa, around the 10th, 11th century, we have another great Indian master who came to Tibet, Lama Atisha. And Lama Atisha brought a couple of systems of practice into Tibet. Most well known, of course, is what's called the Lam Rim instructions. The stages of the path system of practice. But also, he brought into Tibet what's called Lojong system of practice, often translated as mind training. And these are very pithy, short instructions. And Lojong system of practice is particularly well known for being able to transform adverse conditions into the path. Because often we're faced with many adverse conditions, and rather than see them as problems, we can use them as fuel for the spiritual path. So Lojong contains a number of instructions that can help us to do that. These Lam Rim instructions that Lama Atisha brought in were passed, one his main disciple was Drong Tompa. And then we have these instructions, and the Lojong instructions were then actually used by, I think, pretty well all the Tibetan traditions. The Lam Rim instructions passed down through Drong Tompa, and then we have a lineage following that and during that period all these great masters belonged to what a tradition called the Kadampa lineage. Dumpers. And Kadampa, ka here means the word of the Buddha, and dum means personal instruction, and pa means person. So a Kadampa was someone who could see all of the Buddha's teachings as personal instructions to use in life. So the Kadampas were famous for this. And so over a number of centuries, these Lam Rim instructions were passed down through this lineage. And then around the 14th century, we have the great Tibetan master Tsongkhapa.
And he expanded on the Lam Rim instructions, and through his efforts, then we, from that point on, we, this is really what's called then the founding of the Geluk school of Tibetan Buddhism. So that was about the 14th century. Now, when these Mahamudra instructions were passed down through this lineage to Gampopa, what Gampopa did was, he also took the Lam Rim instructions from Lama Ratisha and synthesized together the Mahamudra instructions with the Lam Rim, and then through that, we say that the Kagyu school was formed. So Gampopa is considered to be the founder of the Kagyu school. And then that lineage continues till today, of course. Then the instructions from Lama Tsongkhapa then expanded on the Lam Rim, formed the Geluk school. But also, Lama Tsongkhapa also took the Mahamudra instructions from this lineage. And from that, then Lama Tsongkhapa established Geluk Mahamudra system of practice by synthesizing the Mahamudra instructions from the Kagyu lineage together with his own profound method of realizing emptiness. And so then we have the Geluk Mahamudra being established through Lama Tsongkhapa, 14th century. Then those instructions were also passed down, master to disciple, down to Panchen Losang Chögyi Gyaltsen. And we see his dates here, 1567 to 1662. So we're talking 16th, 17th century. Now, these Mahamudra instructions, this lineage was an oral lineage, meaning the instructions were passed down word of mouth from master to disciple, not written down. And so even when Tsongkhapa established the Geluk Mahamudra, it was still an oral tradition. But then when it finally came down to Panchen Losang Chögyi Gyaltsen, he wrote down these instructions. And so that's this root text here. So that's why it's called the root text for the precious Geluk Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra, because these instructions coming from the oral Mahamudra tradition within the Kagyu tradition, together with Tsongkhapa's own unique, profound way of coming to realize emptiness. So hence, Gelug Kagyu tradition of Mahamudra, or we can simply call it Gelug Mahamudra, because it's sort of understood that Mahamudra is originally coming through the Kagyu tradition. Any questions about that? Yeah. These are all coming, even within the Kagyu tradition, you find that there are a number of different lineages, but they're all coming through the same way, I think. And then at some point, these lineages, often it's because of the style of the presentation, they become actually separate lineages. And so some are more sort of for special trainees who are capable. Some have very pithy instructions, some are more extensive. And sometimes it's also geographical that we end up with these sort of different lineages established. But they're all coming through the same mechanism. Okay.
Now, Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen is quite well known, and the word Panchen here, actually, Pan is actually a short abbreviation of a Sanskrit word, Pandita. And a Pandita is great scholar, someone who's very well, very knowledgeable. And Chen is an abbreviation of a Tibetan word, Chenpo, which means great. So Panchen means great scholar. So Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen was someone who was a great scholar. He was well knowledgeable, very knowledgeable in many areas of practice. In fact, he's very well known, particularly in the area of Tantra or Vajrayana practice. Written many texts in the area of Tantra Vajrayana. Those of you who have some experience within the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism, and maybe have done what's called the Guru Puja, that text was written by Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen. Also, the Medicine Buddha Puja was written by Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen. But he was not only recognized as a great scholar, he was also a great, what's called, adept, siddha. There's a Sanskrit word, siddha, and that's going to come up in the text shortly. A siddha, and often in India we talk about the mahasiddhas. A siddha, often translated into English as adept, means someone who is highly practiced within the Tantra Vajrayana level of practice. They're a high level of practitioner in that level of practice. So Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen was not only a great pandita, a great scholar, he was a great adept, a great siddha. He was recognized as someone who was very highly advanced within the Tantra level of practice. So he's very highly regarded. In fact, in the lineage of the Dalai Lamas, the current 14th Dalai Lama, he often refers back to the 5th Dalai Lama, saying the great 5th Dalai Lama. So the 5th Dalai Lama was considered to be one of the most influential and great Dalai Lamas of the past. And the 5th Dalai Lama's main tutor was Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen. His main teacher was Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen. So therefore, Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen was someone of some substance. So that's the text we're going to follow, is a text written by Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen. So he's now putting in writing these oral instructions that have been passed down from Lama Tsongkhapa, master to disciple, when they got down to Panchen Losen Chögyi Gyaltsen. Then the title here on the front page, it says, The Main Path of the Victors. This word victor here is the translation of a Sanskrit word, jina. And it's a epitaph for the Buddha. So there are, in the text, you often find many different names given to the Buddha, to Buddha Shakyamuni. Jina is one of those. You also see other names like the sage, the teacher, the Bhagavan, many different names. The word jina has a special connotation, as the translation suggests, the victor, the conqueror. Someone who has gained victory over something. So the word jina is indicating that the Buddha, or a Buddha, is someone who's gained victory over two things called the two obscurations.
this is something we're going to look at in more detail later in the text, but just to list them now. The two obscurations that a jinnah or a victor has gained victory over is what's called the afflictive obscurations. Which basically are the mental afflictions, you know, anger, jealousy, craving, so forth, and particularly this fundamental ignorance of reality. And the other obscuration is called the cognitive obscurations. The cognitive obscurations, very briefly, are what's called the stains of the mental afflictions. Because these mental afflictions, of course, create problems in our mind, but they also stain our mind. And these stains obstruct us from achieving enlightenment. So what they really are, both of these we're going to look at in much more detail later. But if we want to achieve enlightenment, we need to overcome, we need to eliminate both the afflictive and cognitive obscurations. So an enlightened person, a Buddha, a jinnah, is someone who's eliminated both of those, has gained victory over them. And here it says it's the main path of the victors, meaning this practice of Mahamudra is the main method we use to achieve that goal. So this is a little bit the title of the text here. So does anyone have any questions about any of this before we actually start to look at the text? Okay, so let's turn over to page 1. And at the top it says, here, in explaining the instructions on Mahamudra from the tradition of the holy beings who are scholars, pandita, so that's the word we saw already, and adepts, siddha, means great practitioner, there are three outlines. So the text he's writing is structured into three parts. And the three parts are it says here, the activities for entering into the composition. It's very traditional, particularly in the Tibetan tradition, that when someone writes the text, the first part of the text is this entering into the composition. And generally it involves two parts. A homage, so the author usually starts by paying homage to someone or something, and then the next part is they make an explicit promise to compose. And this idea of the promise to compose is so that then they actually, once they've made the promise, then of course they're going to finish the text because they've promised to write this text. So this is the two parts of the what's called entering into the composition. Then we have the actual explanation, the actual text. And if we go down a little bit in the middle of page 1, we see that is divided into three parts: preliminaries, actual practice, conclusion. So the first part of the actual explanation is the preliminaries. So again, preliminaries are the foundation practices. What practices do we need to engage in to have a good basis, a good foundation for Mahamudra practice? So that's explained first. Then the actual Mahamudra practice is explained. And if we jump over into page 2 in the middle, the actual practice, we see that is divided into two, Sutra Mahamudra and Tantra Mahamudra. And then just after that, there's a sentence that says, here I will explain the first one, i.e. Sutra Mahamudra, rather extensively. And since the latter one, the Tantra Mahamudra, will be presented using very few words, I will explain that first. So actually, in terms of order of practice, first we would engage in Sutra Mahamudra practice. Once we're well established in that, then we would enter into Tantra Mahamudra practice. But here in the text, the Panchen Lama is saying that because he's going to talk mainly about the Sutra Mahamudra level practice and the Tantra, he's just going to briefly mention it. He'll actually talk about that first, just to briefly mention it. So that's why we have it in that order in this text. But in terms of practice, of course, we practice Sutra Mahamudra until we're well established. Then we can move into the Tantra level of practice. And within the Sutra level of practice, if we go a little bit further into the text, well, actually it's not explicit there, but there are two parts to the practice. There is the shamatha, the concentration practice, the vipassana, the wisdom practice. So in the actual explanation, first, the Panchen Lama is going to explain the shamatha practice of Mahamudra, Sutra Mahamudra, and then the vipassana practice of Sutra Mahamudra. That's the actual practice explanation. And then after that, there's a section called conclusion. And this conclusion has two parts. Conclusion, first part is dedication, meaning what to do at the conclusion of an actual meditation session, dedication. And then also following that is what to do outside of meditation. Because any practice has two parts. Meditation, which is what's explained here, and then what to do outside of meditation, post-meditation. Because if we want any practice to be effective, we need to meditate, internalize, and then we need to integrate into daily life. So here, he's explaining how to do the actual meditation practice of shamatha vipassana, and then later, following the conclusion here, he's going to give some instruction on how to continue to practice Mahamudra in daily life, outside of meditation, what to do. And then, if we go back to the main outline, after the actual explanation, right at the end of the text, there's a dedication of virtue. That it's very common for an author, then, after they've actually finished their writing the text, right at the end, to then dedicate the virtue of having written the text. So this comes right at the end of the text. So this is the structure that we're going to follow in this retreat. And again, remember, the preliminaries or foundation practices, we are going to be meditating each day on the session after lunch. So at 2 o'clock, we're going to be meditating on these practices. And also, you could say that within the foundation practices, we have also the compassion wing of the practice, also can count as a foundation for this Mahamudra practice. And so we're going to meditate on that, of course, in the evening sessions. So the foundation practices, we're going to meditate on twice a day. And then, of course, within the Sutra Mahamudra explanation, the shamatha practice, we're going to meditate, as we've already done today, each day, in the session before breakfast, after breakfast, and this session before lunch. So this is in the morning sessions, the morning three sessions. And then the vipassana practice, we're going to practice the last two sessions in the afternoon. There is going to be the vipassana practices. So that's basically how we're going to go through the text and do the practices according to the various sections of the text. Is that clear? Any questions about that? Okay, then let's jump straight into the text then. So we'll go into the first part of the text. The activities for entering into the composition. So remember again, here, that usually has two parts. A homage, paying homage to someone or something,
and then making a promise to compose the text. So the very first thing we see there is Namo Mahamudraya. So this is Sanskrit, and Namo basically means homage. So it means homage to Mahamudra. So often you'll find at the beginning of, because this is a Tibetan text, you'll often find in the beginning of a Tibetan text, often the title, if it's a translation of a Sanskrit text, you'll find that the actual title is written in Sanskrit to show that this text is not a Tibetan invention, it's coming from the Indian tradition. Likewise here, this is a Tibetan commentary on Indian system of practice, Mahamudra. To really highlight that, again, we see the homage here in the Tibetan text is actually written in Sanskrit to show that this is not, again, a Tibetan invention, but rather it's a commentary about one of the original Indian systems of practice. So that's why we see this Sanskrit here, Namo Mahamudraya, homage to the Great Seal. So again, Great Seal is probably the most common translation of the word Mahamudra into English. So he's paying homage to Mahamudra, but he's also paying homage to his teacher. In the next paragraph, he says, I respectfully bow at the feet of my peerless guru, master of adepts, who directly exposed the great seal of Mahamudra, the all-pervasive nature of everything, the indivisible, inexpressible, and indestructible sphere of the mind. So, a few things to talk about there. First, he says, I respectfully bow at the feet of my peerless guru. The word guru, within Buddhism, certainly within Tibetan Buddhism, implies that the teacher is a qualified practitioner of Tantra or Vajrayana. In the Mahayana tradition, if the teacher is qualified at the level of the Mahayana practice, you'll often find the teacher being referred to as, in Sanskrit, Kalyana Mitra.
And the word Kalyana Mitra, often in English, is translated something like virtuous spiritual friend. This in Tibetan is Geshe. So here, of course, we're talking about a qualified teacher of Mahayana. Ge in Tibetan is short for Gewa, meaning virtue. Shen is short for Shenyan, meaning friend, spiritual friend, virtuous spiritual friend. What we need to realize, however, is nowadays in our modern society, Geshe is simply an academic title. If a monk, and now also nun, has done a lot of study, usually something like 20 years of study, and has passed some academic exams, they're given the title of Geshe. Whether or not they're qualified teacher of Mahayana, not sure, we have to check them out. So nowadays, just because someone's called Geshe this, Geshe that, we should not assume they're a qualified teacher of Mahayana. What we can assume is that they've done a certain amount of study and passed some sort of academic exam. That much we know from the title. Historically, at the time of the Kadampas, we have a lot of the Kadampa masters here have Geshe Langritampa, Geshe Chikawa, Geshe Dromtompa, Geshe this. Then it was simply to acknowledge that they were qualified teachers of Mahayana. It wasn't an academic title. Whereas here we see the word guru. Which is also a Sanskrit word. guru literally means someone heavy with qualities. And it really means someone heavy with qualities in Tantra or Vajrayana practice. So within the Mahayana, particularly in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, when you see someone being called guru, this implies that they're a qualified teacher of Tantra or Vajrayana. Guru, translated into Tibetan, is Lama. Again, we need to be a little bit careful in our modern days, because nowadays, sometimes this word Lama is more loosely used, just as a sign of respect for some elder person, elder monk sometimes. So, just because we see someone now being called Lama this, Lama that, we should not automatically assume they're a qualified teacher of Vajrayana. We need to check them out. But of course, historically, that was the case. So here, we see the Panchen Lama is paying homage to his peerless guru. And his peerless guru, as we're going to later see in the text, is called Sangye Yeshi. And remember, the lineage of Mahamudra instructions in the Geluk Mahamudra came from Lama Tsongkhapa down to Panchen Losam Chögyi Gyaltsen. And so in that lineage, immediately prior to Panchen Losam Chögyi Gyaltsen, in that lineage was his teacher, Sangye Yeshi. So he's saying here that he's paying homage to his guru, his teacher, master of adepts. So again, the word adept here is a translation of the Sanskrit word siddha. And again, siddha implies someone who's highly realized, highly advanced in Tantra or Vajrayana practice. And he's calling him a master of adepts. So not only is he highly practiced in Tantra Vajrayana, he's even a master among those practitioners. He said, who directly exposed the great seal of Mahamudra. So directly exposed means that he basically gave him often what's called these pointing out instructions, that he directly gave instructions which caused Panchen Losam Chögyi Gyaltsen to realize the nature of his own mind. And it says here, Mahamudra, which is given a couple of titles here, the all-pervasive nature of everything. So remember again, emptiness. Mahamudra is referring to emptiness, particularly emptiness of the mind here. That emptiness, the great seal, stamps everything. Everything, the ultimate nature of everything is emptiness. So here it's the all-pervasive nature of everything. Everything has emptiness as its ultimate nature. Nothing exists independently. The indivisible, inexpressible, and indestructible sphere of the mind. So here where, particularly in Mahamudra practice, when we're talking about emptiness, we're really talking of focusing on the mind itself, the nature of our own mind. Hence here, the sphere of the mind. And it says it's indivisible, inexpressible, and indestructible. Indivisible here can mean a few things. One thing that it means is that emptiness and the mind are indivisible. It's not like you have the mind here and then the emptiness over there. They are indivisible because emptiness is the ultimate nature of the mind. Also here it says it's inexpressible, which means that Mahamudra or emptiness is not something that you can express directly through language or concepts, because emptiness, the realization that nothing exists independently, is a realization that everything's interdependent, is a realization that there is no duality, there's no subject-object duality. So this realization of emptiness is a completely non-dualistic experience.
So, therefore, it's inexpressible. Therefore, you can't use dualistic language and concepts to describe a non-dualistic experience. Of course, we can use language to point us towards that, but the actual experience of emptiness is inexpressible. If we come to realize emptiness directly, and we come out of that experience, and someone were to ask us, please tell me, explain your experience to me, you'd go, it was sort of like this, sort of like that. You couldn't use words to describe it because it's beyond, it's a non-dualistic experience, hence inexpressible. And indestructible here is a translation of the Sanskrit word vajra. So we see the word vajrayana. Yana means vehicle. So Mahayana, Maha, as we saw in Mahamudra, means great. So Mahayana means great vehicle. It's a great vehicle because it's a vehicle that can take us to the great goal of enlightenment. Vajrayana, vajra here means, can mean indestructible, indivisible. And again, it can really mean that that emptiness is not something that you can create and destroy. It's not something that you can produce. Hence, indestructible. And it's the nature of all phenomena. It's not something that comes into existence. You can't create emptiness. You can't destroy it. And then Mahamudra, maybe we'll come back to that later, actually. We'll leave that out now. So that is the homage to his teacher. So he's praising his teacher because it's his teacher that gave him direct instructions, enabling him to actually realize the nature of his own mind. So he's paying homage to his teacher, who gave these Mahamudra instructions to him. Then the second paragraph is the promise to compose, to make a promise to actually compose the text. And here he says, I shall write down instructions on Mahamudra coming from the Gelug Kagyu tradition of the supreme adept Dharmavajra and his disciples, a tradition of excellent instructions, having gathered the essence of the sutras and tantras and condensed oceans of oral instructions. So remember, up until the time of Panchen Losang Chögyi Gelsen, this lineage was an oral lineage, you know, word of mouth, master to disciple. So here he's making a promise to write down these instructions, which he received and they received previously, both at the level of sutra and tantra level of practice. And it says here, coming from the tradition of the supreme adept Dharmavajra and his disciples. So we saw that the Gelug Mahamudra lineage was passed down from Lama Tsongkhapa through a number of disciples down to Panchen Losang Chögyi Gelsen. And immediately prior to him, his teacher, who he just paid homage to, was Sangye Yeshi. But in between Lama Tsongkhapa, Sangye Yeshi, I think there was about four or five masters. One of those in that lineage is here Dharmavajra. So Dharmavajra is one of the great masters in that lineage between Lama Tsongkhapa and himself. And he's calling Dharmavajra supreme adept. So when we see the word supreme in terms of adept, so remember an adept is someone who's highly realized, great high-level practitioner in Tantra Vajrayana. A supreme adept is someone, an adept, who has achieved the supreme siddha, the supreme result, which of course is enlightenment. So the fact that he's calling Dharmavajra a supreme adept implies that Dharmavajra is someone who achieved enlightenment. So here he's again making his promise to write down these instructions to complete the text. So, is there any questions about either of the homage or the promise to compose?
Is it written down in the 14th century?
In the 15th, yeah. I think maybe even Panchen Losen Chögyi-Gyaltsen himself, although, I mean, he composed the text, whether he actually wrote the text, but he composed the text and it was written down at that time, yes.
And for the first time?
Yes, as far as I'm aware. So again, Dharmavajra is in the Mahamudra lineage from Tsongkhapa to Panchen Losen Chögyi-Gyaltsen. In fact, I've got it later here in my notes, if I can find it. Yeah, so from Lama Tsongkhapa, his main disciple in the Mahamudra lineage was Tokten Jampol Gyatso, who then passed this lineage down to Bazo Chögyi-Gyaltsen, who then passed it to Dharmavajra in Tibetan, because Dharmavajra is Sanskrit. His Tibetan name is Chöki Dorji. And then he passed it down to Ensapa, who's a very well-known master in Tibetan Buddhism. And Ensapa then passed it to Sangye Yeshe, who was Chögyi Gyaltsen's teacher. So that's the lineage. So Dharmavajra, or his Tibetan name Chöki Dorji, is coming between Tsongkhapa and Panchen Losen Chögyi-Gyaltsen. No other questions, then time for lunch. So let's break for lunch, and then after lunch, we're going to start to look at the actual explanation, particularly we're going to start to look at the preliminary or foundation practices for Mahamudra. So we'll start that at 2:00.